Today I want to talk about healing the fear of unhappiness. Surveys over and over taken of people and what their goals are, what they want, and so on, over the course of, recent years, have always boiled down to this. What people want is happiness. And if you were to look at the television advertising that goes on today, all the products that are marketed are positioned as if they will bring happiness, if only we would buy them. All the makeup, cosmetics, the cars, the jewelry, the exercise, the weight loss, the pharmaceuticals, the surgical procedures, the Botox, the you name it, are all positioned to bring happiness or to associate themselves with the delivery of happiness to us. I wonder if happiness and unhappiness are the primary vibrations that shape us as physical beings. I can imagine that at the beginning of our physical lives, that is just around the time of conception, that happiness or unhappiness was present. You can just imagine that act of procreation, the sexual activity, could have had happiness or unhappiness involved in it. When the mother and the father recognized that they were pregnant, happiness or unhappiness would have been present. Over the course of the pregnancy, those 9 months, our mothers and fathers in normal lifetimes would have experienced and transmitted vibrations of being happy and being unhappy, with one of those probably being predominant for the mother and another one, maybe the same one, being predominant for the father. In the final trimester, happiness and unhappiness vibrations would have abounded. And during the labor period, and during the birth process, we would have been exposed to intense vibrations of happiness and unhappiness as a result of what was happening. I read in a magazine, I don't recall which one, that normal birth results in an amazing rush of endorphins that flood both the mother and the baby's bodies right after birth, creating a tremendous sense of well-being and happiness. That sounds to me like a great way to start the life as an independent human being, with a great rush of happiness and well-being. Last night, my wife Marianne and I watched a movie on television. It was named August Rush, and I recommend it highly. It was about a boy who was separated at birth from his unmarried mother and put up for adoption. He was a musical prodigy, and he had a sense that musical vibrations were what was going to allow him to attract his parents back into his life and allow them to find him. And it was a beautiful movie regarding that, and great production values. But the point I want to make is that August, and that was his name that he took later on in the movie, he was a prodigy with musical vibrations that produced tremendous happiness in him and in others. Can you imagine, even for a moment, if our parents, or us, if we were parents, thought of our children as happiness prodigies, and that we were entrusted with the role of helping them discover the fields in which they could produce happiness? I think that would be amazing. Even today, we could ask ourselves this set of questions. What state of being of mine results in the greatest happiness for me and for others? What doing of mine results in the most happiness for me and for others? What listening, what speaking of mine, what other creative expressions of mine result in the greatest happiness for me and for others? I don't think most people do this. It seems that most people are oriented differently, and perhaps it is better for our survival that we are. If we as cave people had the option to either seek happiness first or to seek to avoid unhappiness first, avoiding unhappiness first probably has a higher survival value. Instead of seeking happiness, we would have attached unhappiness to the unknown, to the dark, to pain, to being killed and eaten by a predator. And in these cases, avoiding unhappiness would have been instrumental in keeping us alive. There are other ways to look at unhappiness, too. One, if we didn't care about other people's happiness and unhappiness, we wouldn't have been able to create tribes or communities or states or countries. Without an appreciation for what another is experiencing when they are happy and when they are unhappy, we could become psychopaths without compassion, without remorse or understanding of the cause and effects of unhappiness. We wouldn't have been able to relate to those other people's experiences. Think Jeffrey Dahmer, for instance. I could say that happiness is a growing together, but unhappiness is a growing apart. One leads to what Bruce Lipton, who we refer to, or I refer to pretty frequently, he labeled one the growth mode and the other the self-protect mode. And I would say growth mode is happiness, or happiness is growth mode, and unhappiness is self-protect mode. Another way to look at unhappiness is that in Western Christian culture, God's unhappiness with Adam and Eve overshadows the rest of the creation story. In the Old Testament, the theme of God's happiness and unhappiness with the individuals, with tribes, with peoples, influence all behavior today. It would be an interesting project for a Bible knowledgeable student to note the presence of expressions of happiness and unhappiness in both the Old and the New Testaments, and just notice how prevalent that theme actually is. In my terms, I would say that Jesus was described as consistently happy, with some instances of being above the fray, perhaps when he was lecturing the rabbis or others like the Pharisees, or the example of when he was unhappy about the money changers in the temples. But by and large, he is shown as even-keeled and perhaps happy. Politically, it's been said that the Jews were awaiting their Messiah, and they were really hoping for a Messiah who is going to be really, really unhappy with the oppressors of the Jews and their current conditions, and not somebody who was happiness-oriented. They wanted an unhappy and vengeful Messiah, and they didn't get one. Jesus demonstrated a different sensibility than the previous models. You remember learning about an eye for an eye. That was a code of justice of earlier times, but that statement I can interpret today as this: you made a person unhappy, so we're going to make you equally unhappy. Logically, I can grasp Jesus's turn the other cheek as an encouragement to choose a different response to another's unhappiness instead of responding with unhappiness. If somebody's unhappy, well, I'll match you or raise you one. He didn't do that. He demonstrated a different idea entirely. We're already familiar with reciprocating with unhappiness if we've watched this. It's been documented, for instance, with Iraq, that Saddam Hussein was unhappy with the first President Bush. Gee, I wonder why. And he wanted him assassinated. That's not hard for me to believe, since the United States, as a country, we've been behind the political assassinations of leaders of other countries for a long period of time. So that Saddam Hussein or any other one would say, gee, I'd like to get into the assassination business. That doesn't seem unreasonable to me. And it's pretty commonly accepted that a person who has an enemy is looking to do harm to that enemy. But the story, documented as well, continues with the second President Bush. He wanted to get rid of Saddam Hussein because Saddam Hussein wanted to kill his father. Oh, you wanted to make my father unhappy? Now I want to make you unhappy. With all the other information that led to the Iraq War, we could boil it down to that. You tried to make my father unhappy, so I will make you unhappy. Weird, isn't it? The unhappiness of just a few men has multiplied to unbelievable amounts of unhappiness for thousands and thousands of families in the United States, Iraq, and elsewhere. Here's another way to look at it. Unhappiness and the threat of unhappiness have been used to control people. I grew up as a Catholic, so I say that in the Christian family, we were taught that God is all-knowing, and sometimes all-loving is mentioned as well, but usually not when control is really the issue or the goal. This God that knows what we think, what we feel, what we do, and is prone to be unhappy with those things that we've done if they violate the multitude of laws, rules, rituals, and dogma that's been established over centuries. Because we can't see God or even get an adequate description from adults about who and what God is, we basically have the beginnings of paranoia. Not Big Brother is watching, but even scarier still, Big God is watching, and He knows all, and He is not happy with you. Children from early ages learn that in catechism and Sunday schools, around the dinner tables, sitting in the pews of churches. That's scary. And on the home front, what child hasn't heard something like these statements? Wait until your father gets home. Wait until your father hears about this. You'll be sorry, that means unhappy. You did that, or you said that. All this early training and being afraid of causing unhappiness connects us in fear. Unfortunately, we attract what we fear. I think there's explanations of that in the Bible. For instance, Job, he makes that point. Rules and laws in society are made ostensibly to avoid the creation of unhappiness. Stop signs, printed information on dry cleaner bags, not to be used as a toy, not to be used in cribs. You know unhappiness resulted in that law. In some cases, the question of whose unhappiness are we talking about needs to be asked. Not in the case of the cribs and the dry cleaner bags. That's pretty clear. That's about babies and that's about parents. But in a lot of cases, laws are made for the greater good. And that's as it should be. But in other cases, the rules and the laws are made to consolidate power and influence in the hands of fewer and fewer people. My idea, I call management by disapproval, is based upon someone deciding that another's existence or another's behavior or another's possessions are the reason for their own unhappiness. The expression of disapproval is designed to stop that being or doing or having. We manage animals this way, with cattle prods, electric fences, choke collars, whips, stirrups, leashes, verbal commands, etc. On a slightly different scale, we do the same thing to school children, Sunday school students, children at home, employees, our peers, our boyfriends, our girlfriends, our spouses, our friends, and even our enemies. Hitler blamed the Jews and other groups for German unhappiness. Communists blamed capitalists for human unhappiness. Capitalists blamed communists for human unhappiness. Stalin murdered thousands of Polish intelligentsia and military officers to prevent them from causing, quotes, unhappiness to his regime. He murdered millions of his own citizens for the same reason. It's unbelievable when you look at history in the context of happiness and unhappiness, and you notice what human beings are so willing to do to visit unhappiness on other human beings. Every country in the world has evidence of this warped reaction to the perception of unhappiness. Of the names I mentioned so far, only Jesus showed the understanding that we had another choice when unhappiness showed up. I believe he knew and taught that unhappiness was not an externally caused condition, but instead of blaming God or parents or luck or fate or others for our unhappiness, we could learn to create our own experiences of happiness. In other words, we could be the prodigies of happiness we were designed to be. Since we came forth from what I call the source of all happiness, and we can imagine an all-loving God, why not take on this identity of being a happiness prodigy? Take on the identity and the responsibility. When we can look at what we do on a day-to-day basis, maybe even minute-to-minute, hour-to-hour, and notice if we use unhappiness to be happy. It can serve that purpose. It can serve that purpose. The next time you get unhappy about something and you run to the chocolate, you go, whoa. You run to the ice cream, the refrigerator, the bar, the martini, the cigarette. You go, oh. Those are really not very acceptable substitutes for the production of happiness because they're externals. They don't really work in the long term. They seem to give a moment's relief, but that's the directionalizing of a response, as far as I'm concerned, taking a non-specific stress response and making it specific is what gives the relief, not the chocolate or the martini or the cigarette that follows. I think we can respond to unhappiness without enhancing unhappiness, without matching it or raising it, as if we were playing poker. We can maintain an even keel like Jesus did. Some years ago, when I lived in New York City, I was on a subway train going to the Bronx pretty late at night. I was the only white person on the train. There was a drunk on the train who lighted a cigarette. Now, it's against the law to smoke cigarettes, or anything else for that matter, on the subways in New York City. I asked him to put out his cigarette, and he started to become belligerent. He was unhappy with me for requesting that. And in this scenario, what I did is repeated, please put out your cigarette. Thank you. Please put out your cigarette. Thank you. Please put out your cigarette. Thank you. We pulled into a stop, and the conductor, who happened to be in his booth in the same train, came out, and the drunk went up to him, and he wanted to know how to react to me. And the conductor said, well, he's asking you politely to put out your cigarette, so I think that's a good idea. And so within a minute, he put out his cigarette. Within another minute, he came and sat by me, shook my hands, apologized for smoking, and thanked me for helping him put out his cigarette. The whole routine. I stayed even keel, and he responded to that even keel. He got unhappy, but then he came back into balance because I was not a threat to him. I was not a threat to him. We could use unhappiness as a weapon or as a tool. But when we use it as a weapon or a tool, we can pretty much expect the other person to understand the game we're playing and reciprocate in kind, to use unhappiness as a weapon or a tool. That other person is likely to match us and raise us one. And that's not really, for the most part, what we want. It's not that effective. It doesn't produce happiness. What causes happiness? My answer is what you are doing with your energy. What you're doing with your energy causes your happiness. So what causes your unhappiness? My answer is this: what you're doing with your energy. What we are doing with our energy is either causing us to be happy or it's causing us to be unhappy. It is not them, that, those, others, things or people or conditions or situations or externalities that are making us unhappy. When we fall into that trap, with falling into it. It is a trap. And that trap is, I ask it as a question, what do we think causes our happiness or unhappiness? And for most people, it's other people, other things, stuff outside of us, stuff outside our control. Going back to TV, turn on the 6 o'clock news and see what the cause of unhappiness is described as. What are they pointing out? They're pointing out on experiences of unhappiness, they're pointing out threats, they're pointing out all of these problems that are the source of unhappiness. And they're telling us, this is what makes you unhappy, this is what makes you unhappy, this is what makes you unhappy. And now that you have all that unhappy energy, you have all that static, you have all that stress, you have all those threat energies in your body, what are you going to do with it? Our challenge is, after we've ingested this kind of energy, is to make it specific. Because if it's non-specific, it is like that tornado that is inside of us, just swirling, 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 not arriving, not leaving, just churning our energy and interfering with our full functioning spiritually, mentally, emotionally, and physically. So if we're going to ingest energy like that, we're certainly going to want to give it specific direction. By exercising, by writing a letter, by you name it. But just to have that tornado swirling inside of us would have done what a lot of people are interested in doing, provoking unhappiness as a means to control other people. I go back to the image of us being prodigies. Prodigies, prodigies. We came from the source of all that is. Does that mean we could be anything or all that we want? I truly believe it does. And if you listen to or read what Jesus has said about God the Father, the God energy working and expressing through him, is what made him capable of doing what he did, and that we had that same capability. It's another way of saying we could be prodigies just like Jesus was a prodigy of spiritual energy, just like August Rush was a prodigy of musical vibrations. We can be prodigies of happiness if we're willing to step into that role, that identity, that right, and that responsibility. Sounds like a great path of happiness. The path is what is happiness, not the destination. The path, the journey, is happiness. I would like to end the service with a prayer. Father God, Mother God, Christ, the Creator in connection to all that is, all happiness. Thank you for all of our blessings. Thank you for helping us increase our awareness of happiness and our ability to connect to it and create it, vibrate to it, demonstrate it, model it, share it. Help us to understand that your vibration is happiness. If we can align with, if we can resonate with, if we can come into harmony with your vibration and see the majesty of your creations on all levels, we would know and feel what you meant back in the creation story when you created one thing after another and declared them to be good, which is another way of saying you are happy with the results of your creation. Thank you. It is so. Amen.